Welcome back to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we are back here with some more information on disaster response. And we're going to be picking up with part two of our two-part series on crush injuries today. And that means not only do we have my lovely and astute co-host, Sam Bradley, with us today, but we also have Dr. Joe Holly back with us. But let's start off with Sam. Sam, welcome back, and it's great to, it's always fun to do this show with you.
Oh, it's always fun to do it with you, Jimmy, and I love the wonderful adjectives that you're giving me. That makes me feel very good. Every time it's something different, but I'm always wonderful, and I really rather like that. But wonderfulness, in my opinion, is Dr. Joe Holly, because this man is a wealth of information on so many different things, and we look forward to talking with you again, Joe.
Well, hi, guys. It's great to be back with you again.
You know, before we get into crush injury, you know, this episode, at the time we were recording this, so we always try to include some current events and things going on. And while pandemic is not, you know, and disease and emerging infectious illnesses is not necessarily a disaster, you know, it is something that's been in the news, and talking about the new MERS, M-E-R-S cases for, I think it's Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, here in the U.S. Not something, even though the news is making a big deal out of it, it's not something that's terribly contagious, Joe. So it's not really something that's on my radar as something to be terribly concerned about.
Well, I think you're right. You know, it's kind of a cousin to the SARS virus, the Southeastern Asian Respiratory Syndrome. No doubt it's got health authorities very concerned. I think there's a lot of concern over how virulent this thing is. We don't really have a good sense of that. And clearly it makes people quite ill. And I think part of the concern with it being outside the areas where it's historically maybe been a bit more known is just the complete lack of immunity that folks that are not from that region might have to the causative agent here, so that it could actually be a whole lot worse here than it might be in an area where it's somewhat endemic.
Wow, what do you know about that, Joe? I'll be honest. I learned of it through some CDC material that came out. I know where, and this is the thing about our present day is the world is so large, and all it takes is someone jumping on a plane and going somewhere that happens to be sick, and then there you go, you know? So the whole pandemic thing is a little scary in how easily it can happen, but what do you know specifically about this disease? How is it contracted? It's viral, apparently, but how is it contracted, and what do you think the actual danger is? I have no sense of that.
Well, my understanding is that it's very similar to other respiratory viruses in that it's, you know, droplet or contact transmitted. I think it can cause a pretty severe respiratory illness that may well result in, you know, a patient being intubated and on a ventilator and requiring a tremendous amount of care to support them. And again, I think a bigger concern is that there's just such an unknown as to how virulent this organism might be and what its effect might be on a population that has extremely low exposure to this particular strain of virus or agent or whatever it turns out to be that's sort of the source, and therefore a concern that it could go big very quickly.
So I would suggest it's a good rule of thumb for all our medical providers out there in general, because respiratory transmitted diseases are scary because you can't see them, and you may be well into a patient assessment before you realize that's what you're dealing with. So wearing proper PPE is probably a good idea. Would you not agree, Jamie?
Absolutely. And, you know, just to keep yourselves knowledgeable and know what's going on, you know, I just quickly did a Google search for CDC and MERS and popped right up. The number one link was right to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on their entire page that talks about MERS cases. And, And so you can look at that. There's a thing about MERS in the U.S. link there, and looking at different aspects of it. So you just need to educate yourselves, know where you're going to go find credible resources. And like Joe said, there are some concerns, but it looks like the CDC's got a handle on what's going on, and you can find up-to-date and current information as well as the best information available currently from that site. And so I would urge you to just do that search and back up your education with the facts. And that's always the best thing to do.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Jamie, because these things, people can freak out about things they don't really know and understand. And so getting the accurate information is really an important factor. And I'm sure if it does start becoming a bigger issue, then we'll start doing more training on local levels with providers, because I think the first thing we need to be concerned about is their safety.
So let's jump in and talk about our topic of this evening as we move into the main section of the show. Joe, we're going to be revisiting our look at crush injury. And when we touched on this before, we talked a little bit about, or a lot about, the pathophysiology and the recognition of crush injury, and that there are some things that you may even present more commonly than just somebody trapped under a heavy object that could resemble or could be actual crush injury just from someone laying in a single position, like an elderly person who falls. So that, and remember that from that, and we'll have links to the original podcast for part one of this segment. But would you like to just kind of go over real quickly an overview of what is crush injury and how we define that?
Sure, Jamie. Basically what's happening in crush injury is muscle tissue primarily, but pretty much any tissue in the body is being compressed to a point where there's direct cell injury or rupture, or at least pretty significant ischemia to those tissues. And that leads to a whole series of changes in those cells that result in the stuff inside the cells leaking out, or for cells that are still functional, some anaerobic metabolism in an effort to stay alive. And while that's obviously damaging directly to those tissues, the real problem comes in the extrication of those patients from that situation, where you lift that compressive force from the extremity, for example, that's trapped, and you flood the central circulation with all of those toxic entities that were previously trapped in the compressed area. Those can have immediate effects on the cardiovascular system and on also the respiratory and renal systems, although that takes a little bit longer. So there are several different bad things going on in that disease process, and it's an issue for us to recognize early on. And what we had talked about before was just kind of building up to understanding that pathophysiology pretty well.
You know, Jamie brought up something that made me think about age, in terms of, because we're going to find people of all ages in a disaster, but I guess we could suffice it to say that anybody's elderly and has a lot of comorbid factors is probably going to be more negatively affected by this. But how do pediatric patients, I think we talked a little bit about a scenario you gave us about a little gal who had her arm trapped, but do children usually rally better from this type of thing?
Well, that's a good question, Sam. There are a lot of variabilities in there. You know, children will tend to have less muscle mass overall, so the compressive, the area of compression may be less. However, they are a bit more sensitive to the high levels of potassium and the severe acidosis and the severe rhabdomyolysis and obstruction of the kidneys and changes in the lungs. So it seems to be about the same. Again, maybe not quite as large an impact, but they are a bit more sensitive. So it kind of evens out.
The same but different.
The same but different. There you go.
So what do you do when you're assessing these patients? So what do you start to look for? You're taking your basic set of vital signs and you're looking at what's going on with these patients. Let's say your team finds an individual and extricates them. What are the steps that you take to begin assessing this person?
Well, I think the key there is as soon as you gain access to a patient who is trapped in a situation like that where they may well have a significant compressive force on them, clearly one of the things that needs to happen is that the medical treatment and assessment of that patient needs to start immediately, certainly well ahead of the progression of the rescue efforts. The last thing you want to do is to have the rescue guys, busy lifting off the compressive load before medically you're prepared to handle that situation. And it's sometimes a bit of a challenge to slow those guys down. They're very type A, and obviously they want to get those patients out of there. But in many cases, if you don't get a look at that patient and get things started early on, you'll be so far behind the eight ball you can't catch up. Part of that assessment process has to do with evaluating the extent of the area that is crushed and beginning to make a determination utilizing the amount of area that's been crushed, the length of time that the crush has been present, and how what sort of state they're in otherwise. If it's been a couple of days, you can certainly assume that those patients are severely dehydrated to start with. And then if you've got a significant crush injury to a lower extremity, for example, it's likely that you have disrupted major blood vessels, et cetera. And as soon as you lift off that crushing load, you're going to expose those disrupted blood vessels and have the patient start hemorrhaging quite severely. So you're simply going to make that situation much worse when the extrication process starts. So the initial piece of that is making that assessment early on before the patient is ready to be moved and initiating some basic treatments and some basic monitoring so that you are ahead of the game a little bit.
Joe, could you reiterate, because I think this is an important part of this, and I know as a medic, we learn about this, but it's easily forgotten because we honestly don't get these kinds of calls with any regularity. What are some of the, and this is when I actually saw your lecture at EMS Today, I was fascinated by what I didn't know. What are some of the really key treatments that you're talking about that really need to be on board before that extrication takes place?
Well, those are directly related to the pathophysiology. So what you're seeing happening to those patients is that as those those cells that have been completely disrupted by the injury or those that have become pretty severely ischemic due to the compressive force, a couple of things happen. The cells that are disrupted completely obviously burst open and leak out into the surrounding tissues, all the stuff that's inside the cell. That's primarily things like myoglobin, the big muscle protein, and potassium, which is also very high in the cell. The cells that are ischemic will struggle along trying to produce energy and stay alive via anaerobic metabolism, a very inefficient metabolic process, which produces lots of acid, uric acid and lactic acid as a byproduct. And as those cells die off, then they also leak out all those other things that we just talked about. So what you're about to do as you lift off that compressive force is flood the core circulation with very high levels of potassium, very, very large amounts of acid. You're also about to make their hemodynamic status much worse by them bleeding out from the disrupted blood vessels that we talked about a few minutes ago. And that leads to sort of the first usual cause of death for most of these patients, which is ventricular fibrillation. That usually occurs because the patient has become severely acidotic and hyperkalemic in a very short time frame. So as you're getting ready to assess those patients, you need some way to know what is going on with some of those parameters. One of the easy ways to do that in the field is to simply put the patient on a cardiac monitor and watch their T wave. As potassium levels increase, the T wave becomes very tall and peaked. And you can literally watch that occur over a few moments. And so as the patient is, you know, treatment is begun and you're monitoring that patient, one of the things you're monitoring, of course, apart from usual vital signs, et cetera, is what's going on with their T wave. And if you're seeing their T wave begin to become tall and quite large, you know what that means is that their potassium levels are increasing quickly and you need to be more aggressive in your therapy. The other monitoring piece of that has to do with some of the more longer term effects of CRUSH syndrome. That's mostly related to not only the severe acidosis, but also the muscle protein myoglobin, which circulates around in the bloodstream and sort of ends up in the kidney. And because it's such a large molecule in a very acidic environment, it is very insoluble in the kidney, and it literally will plug the kidney up, ultimately resulting in renal failure. So if you have a way to monitor urine output on those patients, clearly if it's a prolonged extrication and you have an opportunity to get a Foley catheter in or whatever to assess your fluid status, then you can take a look at the urine and look for that dark tea-colored urine that we see all the time. But you also can simply do a dipstick on that, which is a pretty easy thing to do, and assess whether or not there is hemoglobin or myoglobin in the urine and give you a quick assessment as to whether or not the patient has myoglobinuria.
So as a paramedic, let's just look at it from, because we have different levels of providers that would be involved in this, but say we're at a rescue scene, and we actually, one of the departments I work for had this scenario. It was a person who was working in a trench doing some plumbing that ended up getting buried in there, and we were all scratching our heads because, again, we don't deal with this very often. What's in my drug box? Let's just start at that point, and then we can shift to what may happen in the hospital. But what is in my paramedic drug box that I could use? And I remember the old dreaded tented T syndrome, but what can I do about that, given what I have available on the ALS level?
Sure. Well, let's talk about, you know, treating those different pieces. The first killer is going to be the elevated potassium level. And so the treatment for that is sort of multifold. The first thing we want to do is aggressively rehydrate and fluid resuscitate that patient. That's necessary just to simply restore adequate circulating volume. It's necessary to provide better perfusion to those tissues that may be ischemic, but it also essentially just takes the amount of potassium in the body and dilutes it down, thereby effectively reducing the high potassium levels by simple dilution. The other thing that you can do is whatever is possible, what you're trying to do there is to drive the potassium back into normally functioning cells. And one way to do that is with glucose and insulin. Now, I know we don't usually carry insulin, and so that may be something you have to obtain from a hospital close by or from another resource, of course. But you could simply supply the patient with, for example, an AMPA-D50 and maybe 10 units of regular insulin. Insulin requires potassium to push glucose into the cell, therefore it'll drop glucose levels pretty quickly. The fluid resuscitation piece is also going to be very important there, and these patients may well take liters and liters of fluid. If you look at those folks that may have been trapped for a couple of days, you know, you can certainly assume that they're a liter or two behind simply because they've had poor PO intake for the last 2 days. They've had ongoing insensitive losses. They've continued to sweat. They may have been vomiting. They may have been bleeding. They may have been urinating, et cetera. So they've had losses, but they've had no intake. And therefore, they're simply behind already. And now you're about to put them into more severe hemorrhagic shock when you remove that compressive force. So you can very quickly get 3 or 4 liters of fluid behind on treating these folks.
Well, and it's helpful now, and I know something that's happened here locally is that, you know, we could not get an IV on this guy. In fact, it was odd because he was more afraid of the IV than he was what would potentially happen to him. But now we're able to do humeral head IOs, which would give us a lot better access. But what about albuterol? That was something that fascinated me, that, of course, we're used to using albuterol for respiratory type issues and allergies. But how is that helpful in a CRUSH syndrome?
Well, actually, it is. You know, for a lot of significant collapse, there tends to be a lot of respiratory issues associated with it, just because collapse generates tremendous amounts of dust that are inhaled by the patient, because, of course, they're trapped there and they have no choice but to breathe in all that heavily laden, contaminated air. So they often have a lot of respiratory issues that will benefit from albuterol. But there is a nice side effect of albuterol in that it also causes potassium to move into the cell. It's not a huge effect, but it's small, but it is, in many cases, a small amount may be enough to keep the patient from fibrillating and be enough to make the difference. So it's certainly another tool in the toolbox. One of the other sort of old school tools is the use of calcium. You remember back in sort of the old ACLS days, we would give potassium a lot. Calcium is effective. You know, it sort of competes a little bit for the channels that potassium is working through, and it helps to sort of counter the effects of elevated levels of potassium. So it's got a little bit of a cardioprotective effect to it as well. The other thing that's going on there is that particularly the heart is quite a bit more sensitive to elevated levels of potassium when it is in a very acidic environment. So if you can reverse the severe acidosis of the patient, you can reduce the sensitivity to potassium and therefore make them less likely to have cardiovascular side effects from high potassium levels.
So what, bicarb? I remember how much we used to use that in the field, and then it kind of fell out of favor. But in this instance, I think there's a role for it.
There's absolutely a role for it. You know, I think early on in the cardiac arrest scenario that we used to use it in a lot, most of those patients had not had much of an opportunity to become severely acidotic. It does take a little bit of time for that buffering process to start and for the patient to become pretty severely acidotic. And we're so much better at cardiac arrest now that we don't see it as often as we used to. But in these situations where there's been a prolonged period of anaerobic metabolism, the acidosis can be quite profound. And getting those patients large doses of bicarb are vitally important.
What about when you talked about fluids? Do we need to balance that with trying to get access to some kind of blood products, because we are dealing with a hemorrhagic shock situation potentially, and not just giving them crystalloids, but also looking at giving them something that's going to replace their oxygen carrying capacity?
Well, you're exactly right, Jamie. Obviously, there is a component of that going on if the crush is severe and the hemorrhage is severe as well. For most of those patients, the bleeding will have stopped after some period of time from the crush and the compressive force, simply because they're still alive, you know, far in time into one of these instances. So initially, the ability to get access to typed and matched blood products for those patients is really challenging. And so most of it's going to be a more crystalloid response. What is done commonly would be a couple liters of normal saline initially, maybe with some bicarb of carb in there as you get ready to remove that compressive force and extricate the patient. And then as you begin to sort of see where you are in the process and a better estimate of the extent of crush injury of this patient and sort of what his potassium level appears to be doing and all that sort of stuff, then you can move to something like D5W and add 2 to 4 amps of bicarb to that, which will bring you up to a solution that's close to normal saline in its sodium content, but will have a lot of bicarb floating around in it so that you counter that severe acidosis that the patient is currently being exposed to.
So now you, Nurse Jamie and Dr. Joe, have this patient in the ER. What other things can you do that we didn't previously do in the field?
Well, there are other things that can be done. Certainly, as Jamie already mentioned, restoration of blood products can be vitally important in those patients. Not so directly, with the crush syndrome, but obviously they need the oxygen carrying capacity for those tissues that have been ischemic, and to simply replace the losses that have already occurred. The dialysis may be beneficial in those patients to quickly bring their acidosis under control and to take some of the load off the kidneys. We'll kind of come back and talk about the kidneys in just a minute. And to bring the potassium levels down. You can also administer potassium binding agents like K-Exalate and some of those kind of things that absorb potassium. You give this to the patient in their GI tract, and it absorbs calcium across the barrier of the gut, and you obviously pass it on out of the body from there. So that's another way that you can do that. In general, if you've managed to get the patient extricated into the ED, then you've, in most cases, done a pretty good job on the scene of managing the short-term dangers, which are the severe acidosis initially, along with the hyperkalemia. So if you can keep their cardiovascular system working until you get them to the hospital, then you've kind of got them past the first hurdle, and you can move on now to worrying about second, third, and fourth hurdles with these folks, because the problem now begins to shift into things like the myoglobin plugging up the kidney and causing renal failure, which of course wreaks havoc with electrolyte metabolism and all sorts of other things. The lung also has quite a response to all of this foreign material that's been dropped back into the circulatory system from the mangled extremity that's now floating around in the bloodstream and is seen as a foreign invader. So the body initiates a pretty impressive inflammatory response to try to figure out what that is and what's that doing here. That, of course, leads to things like adult respiratory distress syndrome, shock lung, all those comments from the past. One of the other things that's vitally important here has to do with the effect of myoglobin in the kidney. And while we're aggressively trying to reverse the severe acidosis that these patients have in order to protect their heart, the other thing that's really important to understand is that the solubility of myoglobin with a pH of about 7.4 to 7.35, which is fairly normal pH, is 5 or 10%. If you can change the urine pH to about 7.55, which is not a huge change, you increase the solubility of myoglobin to about 80%. And so you, in essence, by alkalinizing these patients, really increase the amount of myoglobin that the kidney can pass out and therefore salvage the function of the kidney down the road. So these patients can come through that with pretty normal renal function, which obviously is a whole lot better than dialysis, not only in the short term, but the long term as well. So it's vitally important to aggressively alkalinize these patients and their urine so that you flush that myoglobin out of the kidney and maintain the function.
So step one is getting him to the ER alive, and I guess that's a big piece of it. But now you're talking about all of these other things that can happen after the fact. What is the survival rate for someone who has a pretty severe crush syndrome?
Well, it can be pretty poor. You know, the downside, of course, is that there are so many different things that can go wrong, as we've been talking about, from the, you know, the acute hyperkalemia related stuff to hemorrhagic shock to, you know, ARDS to renal failure. You know, we haven't even talked about things like significant sepsis. Most of those folks with pretty severe crush are going to need some sort of operative intervention on the crushed tissue just to debride that and repair whatever can be repaired, et cetera. So the mortality can be pretty substantial on this, and obviously can linger along for quite a while. It's a very long recovery process, and there are a lot of pitfalls along the way that can capture patients. There's not an awful lot of data on it, and I think the reason for that is that if someone has a severe crush injury and ends up in a trauma ICU and dies later of sepsis or ARDS, it's really challenging to say, well, was that definitely related to crush syndrome, or was that just, you know, part of their traumatic state? And maybe it's all part of the same thing. Some of that's probably just semantics. But so the numbers are a little bit hard to sort out. To know exactly what you're ascribing the ultimate mortality to.
Jamie, it sounds like this would be a great cross post for the nursing show.
I think so. And I have to say, you know, just hearing this, you know, with I have my nursing cap on right now, it seems that really it requires some very close monitoring of labs and multi-system function of lab monitoring, because there's so many different systems in the body that are being affected.
Well, I think you're exactly right, Jamie. You know, once you get to an ED where resources are quite a bit more substantial, then, you know, you can look at everything from arterial blood gases with pH and all that sort of stuff to, you know, actual electrolyte measurements that are difficult to obtain in the field. You might can get some of those from some of these, you know, point of care systems like iStat and some of those. But obviously that's not something that a normal EMS service would carry around routinely. But those would be pretty valuable, you know, measuring what the urine myoglobin is doing. The other thing that can also occur with these patients, sort of in conjunction with the significant inflammatory response that most of these folks get, is that massive amount of disruption of the vascular system turns on, obviously, all of the clotting mechanisms in the body that see that as, you know, massive open injury that needs to be clotted off. And so those patients, if they have really severe vascular impact, even if it's a lot of microvascular impact, can have all kinds of coagulopathies where they totally consume all of their clotting factors because of the massive amount of endothelium that's being exposed in the vascular system and the massive consumption of that stuff. So those patients can end up with, bleeding out from something else, or, you know, severe coagulopathies that ultimately could result in their death as well.
Good grief, such a complex subject. Is this something you guys cover in any of your training at Paragon?
It is indeed. Obviously, it's a disease process that's fairly unique to disaster medicine. As we talked a little bit about in the prior episode, you know, it's stuff that we see pretty frequently, but the time frame is very different, and it's that time element that really makes this disease process one, seem unusual, and two, make it the problem that it can become in those scenarios, because that time element is orders of magnitude worse than what we would do on a day-to-day basis.
Well, we thank you for what you do at Paragon, because obviously you entertain some training that you just can't get anywhere else. And I know you're doing some active shooter stuff right now, correct?
That is correct. Yeah, it's certainly, unfortunately, a pretty hot topic right now. So we've got another big class coming up in the Memphis area, and several things working across the country.
Yeah, it's you guys really bring a unique aspect of education to the table, and I would urge everybody to check out the resources that Paragon Medical Education Group brings to their training segments in all of the various types of training you do. Joe, where can folks find Paragon?
Well, Paragon is on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com and on Facebook as well, Paragon Medical Group. And our Twitter feed is ParagonMedEDU.
Excellent. Well, and we'll make sure that, as always, we appreciate your support of the Disaster Podcast. And so folks can always go to disasterpodcast.com and follow the links there to Paragon Medical Group if they want to. But we urge you to check out the amazing training and education resources that are available and maybe bring this incredible experiential training to your organization or your region and give an opportunity to do full system-wide education, which is one of the things I like. You know, we're talking about crush syndrome and dealing with the patient from the point of recovery all the way where you actually find them and get them extricated all the way through to their care in the hospital. And that's one of the things you all focus on is bringing that entire healthcare system, that disaster response system, to the table so that the hospital side is there working alongside police and fire and EMS and even federal responders.
Well, you're exactly right, Jamie. Those are situations where multiple disciplines from multiple sources all have to pull together to pull that off.
Sam, how about you? Where can folks find you?
Well, hopefully you'll find me as a student at Paragon one of these days.
Absolutely.
The more I learn, the more fascinated I get. I'm in the usual social media places, Sam Bradley on Facebook, Sam Bradley 11 on Twitter, and most certainly at disasterpodcast.com. And where do they find you, Jamie?
Well, you can find me most everywhere on social media sites under the handle PodMedic. And if you don't look for me there, you can always find this and all the shows that I work within as the host or the producer over at MedicCast.com. And, of course, the Disaster Podcast is also a member of the ProMed Network. So you can find that there as well. But, you know, it's great to talk about crush injury, and I want you to keep coming back to DisasterPodcast.com and let us know what you want to hear more about. And we're going to definitely be continuing to tap into Joe Holly as a resource to talk about some of the unique pathophysiology and the illnesses that were common in a disaster setting.
Absolutely. This is information you just can't get anywhere else. And I agree with Jamie. Please do let us know what you'd like to hear more of, because I'm sure Dr. Joe would love to tell you about it.
So, Sam, why don't you close us out and take us on home?
Well, I think Dr. Joe has clearly made the case for the fact that disaster medicine is not everyday medicine.